Bloomberg Audio Studios. Podcasts, radio, news. You're listening to the Bloomberg Balance of Power podcast. Catch us live weekdays at noon and 5 p.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Listen on demand wherever you get your podcasts or watch us live on YouTube.
Keeping track of the headlines out of the Middle East, as we already said, there have been reports of 10 missiles being fired at U.S. bases in Qatar specifically. And now Iranian state television is saying that a, quote, powerful, devastating strike was launched at Al Udeid Air Force Base, Air Base. That, of course, is the biggest U.S. military installation in the Middle East. It is the headquarters of U.S. Central Command. And Iranian state TV has cited an IRGC statement on the missile strike heading toward Qatar. We knew, Joe, that retaliation was likely coming. Iran's Armed Forces Chief of Staff earlier today said it would be proportionate and decisive. I guess we're getting a sense of what the regime's take on proportionate and decisive actually is.
That's right. It's been a flurry of headlines over the past hour or so. Now Iran, according to Axios, launching at least one missile toward Iraq, where there's also a large military base, but not nearly the number of U.S. troops who are there. If reports are correct, they're already in the Situation Room at the White House, and there was a scheduled meeting for the president and his national security team at this hour. Bloomberg's Tyler Kendall is joining us with the very latest from the North Lawn at the White House. Tyler?
Yeah, hey, Joe. Well, as you mentioned, we are expecting that President Trump has already convened his National Security Council inside the Oval Office. We should say that this was always on the public schedule, but now we could see perhaps some sort of confirmation out of the White House as we wait to see if any officials make some sort of statement when it comes to the reports of these missiles being launched towards that U.S. airbase in Qatar. Now, we should say, as Kaylee had mentioned at the top, retaliation was widely expected, considering that we had heard from the Chief of Staff of Iran. Armed forces earlier today saying that a response would ultimately be proportionate. And we had been tracking moves when it came to Qatar. We know that they had suspended flights over their airspace earlier today. The U.S. embassy there had also warned that Americans should start to shelter in place. Of course, as mentioned, this is one of the largest U.S. military bases in the Middle East. It's home to about 9,000 U.S. service members. Now, this White House has maintained that it had been proactive about protecting U.S. assets in the region. Of course, you'll recall last week we saw them move personnel out of Iraq. But now the question really does become, would this provoke further U.S. retaliation? President Trump had threatened that there could be further attacks if Iran did not come to the negotiating table when it comes to their nuclear program. But Joe and Kaylee, we have heard reiterated by Iranian officials that they are not going to be able to negotiate if the strikes do continue against them. Of course, that then begs the question about a potential ceasefire, which up to this point, we really haven't seen President Trump be too in favor of. Of course, we have heard him say before that he is looking for what he calls unconditional surrender.
Well, as we consider what response the president may choose for this action, we should note that Qatar is now saying that it intercepted that missile barrage on Al Udeid Air Base. Qatar says there was no incident and no casualties from the missile attack, and that could be important in the considerations of the Trump administration as it decides whether or not to retaliate if there were indeed no casualties from this attack. Again, this is coming from Qatar. We'll have to await word from the White House as well, Tyler. But if indeed we were to see an additional military action that this administration wants to take, is there a sense that they might go to Congress for approval for that in a way they did not with this strike over this past weekend?
Well, up to this point, Kaylee, this White House has really maintained that it has complied with the War Powers Act of 1973. We're going to hear this talked about a lot in Congress, as there does appear to be some sort of a movement, even among Republicans who were upset about President Trump moving forward with this authorization of military force without congressional approval. But we heard from Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth, who really has maintained that they have complied with that law. And we should say that presidents of both parties in the past have authorized military strikes without congressional approval. But that really does become one of the factors here as the White House does weigh its decision moving forward. Yet President Trump has been pretty staunch in his rhetoric when it comes to making sure that he is protecting U.S. interests abroad if there were to be some sort of retaliation. We're going to be watching really closely as how this does play out, because our analysts at Bloomberg had been expecting perhaps a more targeted strike. So we'll see. You're reading the headlines there from Qatar about what potentially the damage could ultimately be. But there were a few different options that Iran did have on the table. So we'll be watching to see if this expands any further and what this White House's response would be.
All right, Bloomberg's Tyler Kendall live at the White House for us as we contend with this breaking news. Thank you so much. And again, to reiterate, as Qatar says, it has successfully intercepted Iran's missile attack. It is also Qatari response we have to consider here, as Qatar is saying it reserves the right to respond to this, quote, blatant attack from Iran. And of course, that's just one player in the region that is factored in here as well. The other being, of course, Israel, as it continues its own strikes on Iranian nuclear infrastructure and other assets. And Iran has fired retaliatory missiles at Israel in return. We have seen that for days. We saw it again, once again today. And an important voice is joining us now here on Balance of Power on Bloomberg TV and radio. I'm pleased to say Yoav Gallant, the former defense minister of Israel, is with us live. Sir, we appreciate your time. As we consider this response from Iran targeting U.S. military assets in the region, is this in keeping with what you expected? Do you think it ends here, or could we still see yet more from the regime?
Well, good afternoon, Joe and Kaylee. Thank you for having me. And I think that the bold decision that was taken by the president and the excellent performances of the American Air Force, and nobody else, no Air Force in the world can do anything similar to that. This is an essential step in order to make sure that Iran will not possess nuclear weapon. Imagine that one of these ballistic missiles that was shooted to Qatar, to Israel, could have carried a weapon of mass destruction. This can be a disaster, not only for the region, but for the world. Therefore, we need to avoid it. And in this region, in the Middle East, peace comes through strength. Unfortunately, you need to explain the aggressor that there are limits to what they can do. And the Iranians were very, very close to possess a nuclear weapon.
We'd like to know more about what could happen next, Mr. Gallant, based on the extent that you're still in touch with your contacts. How broad and at what scale could be this response from Iran? We have reports of 10 missiles in the air. So far, it appears those fired toward Qatar have been intercepted. Will Iran need to resort to terrorism if it cannot strike militarily against the U.S.?
I think that the major tool that Iran has will try to use is ballistic missiles, also other type of missiles and drones. And they are shooting them against Israel in the recent 2 years, and especially during the last week. And I believe they made a grave mistake by retaliating against American base and American interests, because I'm sure that the president will retaliate or order to retaliate exactly as he promised in the past. And the proportions between the Iranian capabilities and the Americans are bringing Iran to a very low point to the corner. And I think that the Central Command, CENTCOM of the U.S. Army will retaliate against them in order to explain what is the meaning of such a behavior. But we are lucky that all these missiles were intercepted in the air. And let me say that for me, the lives of Americans and the life of American soldiers are as dear as the life of Israeli soldiers. I started to train with American soldiers when I was commanding the Navy SEALs, the Israeli Navy SEAL, 40 years ago. And I appreciate them, and they are very dear for me, and I value very much their performances and their abilities. And we will do anything that we can in order to support American efforts, Intel, and anything else needed.
Well, General, as we consider the support that Israel might need and has gotten from the U.S., while Qatar has successfully intercepted this attack from Iran, obviously not all of the missiles and et cetera that Iran has sent Israel's way over the course of the last week or so have been intercepted. How should we consider Israel's own air defense capability if Iran were to introduce more advanced missiles into this fighting? Is that something Israel is prepared for and can withstand for potential a prolonged period of time?
Oh, yeah. You know, this war started recently, but last autumn, on September, we eliminated Hezbollah. And on October, we made two major steps when we retaliate against Iranian aggression when they were shooting at us 200 ballistic missiles on October 1st. We retaliate, and actually we create and pave the way for what we are seeing now. Once we almost demolish all their ability to manufacture ballistic missiles, so they stay with the arsenal they have, around 2,000, maybe 2,500 ballistic missiles when they start with. And second, we were able to pave the way to Tehran and to create a corridor and later on air superiority. That also was part of the assist that we gave to the Americans when they hit the Fordo. So looking on the situation, the Iranian will suffer heavy damage and heavy casualties and everything that is either Revolutionary Guard or military bases or regime bases. This all is exposed to Israeli and American potential retaliation. So in one hand, we are well equipped to protect ourselves. We are able to engage and detect the missile launchers on the ground. And we are doing it successfully. We degraded them from 400 to, I believe, less than 200. And with America retaliating from bases and carriers, I think that the Iranians are in a very bad position. And that means that for them, they should stop and accept the conditions that President Trump put on the table. Otherwise, we will do it by force. But you cannot allow a country that is based on irresponsible regime to possess nuclear weapon in the center of the Gulf.
You mentioned Fordo. It is possible the IAEA will never get inside Fordo, and there are questions in Washington and around the world about the extent to which the U.S. eliminated the entire facility or whether there could be something left over. Will Israeli special forces go there firsthand, in person, to find out?
Well, Fordo is a few hundred feet under the surface.
Yeah. Can you access that facility in person?
We know these places, and we know what was going over there. We believe that the American mob that was dropped from the B-2s was penetrating Fordo. And America has the ability to retake those places if needed. Anyhow, I think that the whole system under the ground was collapsed, together with what was happening in Natanz and with other facilities that are dealing with the Iranian nuclear program in Isfahan and in Kashan, Natanz, and other places. I think that we set them back by many years. And if you look on the general picture, including what happened to the protecting shells that they created in the past, like Hezbollah and Hamas and the Syrians, everything collapsed, including the Iranian air defense. So they are very exposed. And the regime is fighting for their life. And this is the reason, I believe, that they need to retaliate. Otherwise, the 90 million Iranians will understand that the regime is very weak and this is an option to change the regime by the people in Iran. Therefore, they need to show strength to their own people. But it's a grave mistake because they are going to lose more and more asset because of those reaction. Every day, we are setting them back by a few months.
Well, as you allude to the idea of regime change here, do you believe that is Israel's ultimate objective in this war or this conflict? Do you believe there's alignment between Israel and the U.S. in that regard?
I don't think that this is a declared aim, a declared goal of a war. The goal of the war is to make sure that Iran will never possess nuclear weapon and to destroy their ability to produce fissile material and weapon system that activate it by eliminate the scientists and the centers that deal with that. But having said that, air campaign cannot change a regime, but on the other hand, it weakened the regime. And in this aspect, it gives the people of Iran the opportunity to change the regime if this will be their choice. We cannot, and I don't think that we are aiming to change the regime from the air campaign, but the international media, together with the people in Iran, and the air campaign that Israel and the United States are holding against Iran, can create conditions for the people in Iran.
Mm-hmm. If you're with us on Bloomberg TV or on YouTube or Bloomberg Originals, we're showing you the first video that we have of missiles being shot toward Qatar, where they were intercepted. This is home to the massive U.S. airbase that we've been describing and the Iranian retaliation, if you're just joining us, that began shortly after 12 noon Eastern time. Yoav Gallant, in our final moment of conversation, do you expect that we'll see Israeli forces on the ground in Iran?
I don't think so. I don't think it is needed. And I'm not sure that the effect of it is something that is needed. Iran is a big place, huge comparing to Israel. Mm-hmm. It's 60 or 65 times larger than Israel. The population is 9 times bigger. The Iranian people are not our enemy. And we are fighting to eliminate their ability to possess nuclear weapon, because you know, on every missile it is written death to Israel and also death to America. And if they possess nuclear weapon, they will use it. Therefore, as a Holocaust survivor's son, a son of a Holocaust survivors, for me never again is not just a commitment. For me never again is a manual. We are working according to it, and we need to make sure that those who threat to eliminate Israel, and by the same words, the Jewish people, who most of it, majority of it, stay in Israel, the meaning is that they are serious about it. So we need to take preemptive actions, and that's what we are doing.
He is the former defense minister of Israel, Yoav Gallant. General, thank you for the time and insights today.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Balance of Power podcast. Catch us live weekdays at noon and 5 p.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
Michael Allen with us from Beacon Global Strategies, where he's managing director and a veteran of the Bush White House, a national security expert who has seen this coming. Michael, it's good to have you back with us here in studio on Bloomberg. To what extent is Israel finishing the job right now as opposed to widening it?
So I think Israel is somewhere down their target list in terms of military and nuclear targets. And to me, they're beginning to hit more economic and regime stronghold targets. So I have a real question as the week goes on, because they're debating how long do we want to keep this going, mm-hmm. whether they shift completely toward a regime change type policy. And to me, that's sort of the biggest question ongoing in the real war, which is between Israel and Iran.
Well, so when we consider that being the quote-unquote real war, how long would you expect it to continue if Iran has already chosen its course of action against the U.S., or do you think it might not end against the U.S. at this point either?
I think it's basically over against the United States. They did their symbolic attack on Al Udeid Air Force Base, as your correspondent noted, completely telegraphed, probably coordinated between intermediaries. What I don't think, though, is that it's over with Israel. I think Israel, by the way, not only is going to continue to prosecute its target list, at least for this week and maybe beyond, but to me, as long as they have air superiority in Iran, I think Benjamin Netanyahu is going to carry on a campaign of where they have an opportunity that's going to be quite opportunistic. They're going to go for it. That's exactly what they do with Hamas, and that's what they do with Hezbollah. I think it's going to go on for weeks and weeks.
And we should note that they were trading fire as recently as today.
Yes.
That we've spent a lot of time talking about Iran's response to the U.S., but Israel is still deep in this right now. You brought to us the importance of Fordo, knowing that this would be in our sights if, in fact, we decided to strike. It has now happened, and Bloomberg is reporting that satellite images that we've seen of that area following U.S. strikes show that the U.S. Air Force intentionally avoided hitting reactors at Fordo and Isfahan during the attack on Saturday night. What do you make of that decision, and does that imply to you that there is, in fact, more to be done here, that the deal is not closed to end the nuclear program in Iran?
So avoiding the reactors is smart because they don't want to cause some radioactive incident. Apparently, if you hit the stored uranium, it's not as big of a radioactive activity than hitting a reactor. But I do think that the United States still has some interest here in seeing that Israel continue to prosecute some of the nuclear targets going forward. Mm-hmm. I think it's fair to say no one is quite sure today where the HEU is. I know the vice president mentioned on air yesterday that it might have been diverted before we hit
this is Fordo. The highly enriched uranium
stockpile. This is the 60% highly enriched uranium stockpile. All of this, to me, however, suggests something that I think the United States would be wise to set expectations better. It is true that we had a successful attack the other night. It is true that we probably could have hit some of these sites, and I wish we had hit Isfahan harder. But this program has been going on for decades. There are dozens and dozens of sites. The Iranians are experts at denial, deception, and subterfuge. It won't be outlandish to think that we might have missed something, or that the Israelis, as good as our intel is, might have missed something also. I think we just need to understand that we severely degraded them. We had totally lost the bubble on Iran in the last few years. We have regained the initiative, and it may just take a sustained effort from Israel over time to keep up.
Well, when we consider, and I know you said you think at least between the U.S. and Iran in terms of military action, it might be over for now. Iran still has non-military options available to it, like, for example, just stop cooperating and leave the treaty, the nuclear non-proliferation treaty. Yeah. Make sure the IAEA can't get eyes on anything. We asked John Bolton, the former national security advisor, about this last night on our special coverage, and he was like, well, they haven't been abiding by it anyway, so it's really not a concern. But I wonder if you view it the same way. Don't we need eyes on at least what we can see in regard to Iran's program?
So I think all told, it was good that we had IAEA inspection capability, but they didn't show us everything. And so at some level, it becomes confusing for the international community to think, well, the IAEA is in there, so we must have eyes on everything. We don't. They were letting us see what we wanted to see, and I think while it was beneficial to have it, over time, the usefulness declined because in the aggregate, the whole program got way out of whack. They had so much more HEU than they should have. They were reportedly building a third centrifuge site that they had only begun to mention to the IAEA. And all these weaponization sites, the Iranians have been shutting the IAEA out of those for years. So I think we set them back. I think the Israelis really are the ones that set them back on nuclearization. I hate to lose the IAEA, but I mean, all things equal, I think we're better off in the long run.
We've got a headline that just crossed the terminal. Kuwait says it now is temporarily closing its airspace. With everything that we've heard in the last hour, does this feel de-escalatory? as some have suggested, on Iran's part? Or are you still waiting to see if there's a fulfillment of this threat to activate sleeper cells, that there's a completely other element here that involves terror?
So I think over time, this is the primary tool that the Iranians have.
Terrorism?
Yes, they're a state sponsor of terrorism. I think they are flat on their backs. They have tried to assassinate U.S. officials over the last several years here and have failed. They tried to recruit people in chat rooms, and the FBI was onto them very quickly before anything materialized. I think over time, the Iranian regime will try to return to that, maybe to hit embassies overseas, certainly maybe targets of opportunity if they're soldiers that are unprotected. But I have a hard time seeing them succeed in a big way here in the United States. That's not to rule it out completely, because I know they want to get over here, but I really don't see it as a huge threat, because I believe that we have superior intelligence, as do the Israelis, to tap into their computer systems and get some sense of what they want to do to us long before it goes kinetic.
As we're tracking the markets here, Michael, it is worth noting we're down nearly 6% on both Brent and WTI futures right now. We're actually south of $70 a barrel on WTI, which is where we were before Israel's initial strike on Iran on June 13th. This is the lowest level we've seen since June 12th. As we consider now, and Joe just mentioned the headline, Kuwait has closed its airspace. Al Samaria TV is also saying Iraq has done the same, in addition to Bahrain, Qatar, the UAE.
Yeah.
If the airspace isn't safe, should operators of cargo vessels, of oil cargo specifically, feel that the Strait will be safe moving forward, the Strait of Hormuz?
Yeah, I don't think that the Iranians are really going to go and do the Strait of Hormuz for several reasons, in part because Oman owns half of it, in part because it would be taking off their nose to spite their face. I do wonder, though, if they're beginning to shut down the air space over Kuwait and elsewhere, maybe there are more attacks to come from the Iranians. Maybe they're going to try to take a shot at our base in Kuwait. They definitely did, by the way, in Iraq at Al-Assad. The question is all of this choreographed? I think it is, because the quickest way for the Iranians to lose control of the situation is to kill an American. And then I fully believe that Donald Trump would go extraordinarily kinetic on them. We have three carrier strike groups in the region, a half dozen air squadrons of F-35s. I think that is something that Trump would prosecute to the hardest. So I really doubt that they're sincerely trying to hit us.
All right, Michael Allen, great to have you as always, Managing Director at Beacon Global Strategies. Also, of course, former Special Assistant to President George W. Bush, serving in a national security capacity. We appreciate it. And as we consider the Strait of Hormuz and what we're seeing in oil prices today, again, down the better part of 6%, we want to turn to Bloomberg TV and Radio's resident commodities expert, Alex Steele, is with us. She hosts Bloomberg Intelligence on Bloomberg Radio, as well as The Close on Bloomberg TV. So, Alex, obviously a pretty remarkable move to the downside when many came in today thinking that we might see a massive spike in oil prices because of concern in the Middle East. It seems that commodities traders, at least, are thinking this might be an all-clear sign.
Yeah, I guess if you take away the worst-case scenario, that's actually helpful for lower oil prices. Couple things to consider, though. One, Halima Croft at RBC said over the weekend that she would caution against that knee-jerk reaction that, quote, the worst is behind us. Now, the other factor to consider here, irrespective of the supply issue that may or may not happen with Iran, is the demand side. So there's been a lot of stockpiling by China, a lot of stockpiling by other countries within the West as well. Iran was also exporting a lot more than normal before these strikes took place, and China was really stockpiling them, meaning that they're not going to be that huge demand pull if something does happen to the oil supply. Second, JP Morgan says that without any drama, they see a mid-60s range for oil for the remainder of 2025. So in essence, a WTI at 69, there's still even a little bit more geopolitical premium baked in.
Boy, this seems like there's a heck of a lot of confidence without knowing what's going to happen next year. Alex, how much of this rides on this tit-for-tat ending here? We've talked about any number of attempts that Iran could make to interrupt energy flows. We've heard about the Strait of Hormuz and so forth. Are those all extreme scenarios that this market is ruling out?
I mean, pretty much at this point, like ruling out the Strait of Hormuz was really about taking out a lot of geopolitical risk premium within the oil price. Mm-hmm. That is clearly the absolute worst case scenario. There are some things that range, like if you take out 1.75 million barrels of oil a day, this is Goldman Sachs saying this, then you'd see oil rise to $90 a barrel. If the oil through the Strait of Hormuz were to drop by just 50%, remember 20 million barrels of oil a day of fuel and oil flows through that, reduce that to 50%. And you could see oil maybe 10% higher for another 11 months. So clearly, that's the worst case scenario. That clearly is not happening at this moment. Can we rule it out altogether? Alima Croft says, no, you can't. But it doesn't mean that it actually will happen. Many say that that would wind up hurting everybody, including Iran. However, you have to make an argument, too, that why would Iran want to cut off any oil supply to China? But again, like I mentioned, China's been stockpiling, right? So the immediate impact might not be that bad. And when you have nothing to lose, there's still that risk that is that should be calculated within the market.
Alex Steele, what a treat to have Alex with us here on this program, the host of Bloomberg Intelligence on Bloomberg Radio, but of course, our commodities expert, as Kaylee mentioned. Thank you so much for the insights, Alex.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Balance of Power podcast. Catch us live weekdays at noon and 5 p.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Listen on demand wherever you get your podcasts or watch us live on YouTube.
Have been waiting to see what we will hear from the White House and from President Trump in the aftermath of this Iranian retaliation against the U.S. And we did just get a Truth Social post from the president. However, it is not about missiles being sent toward a U.S. airbase in the Middle East. Instead, it seems to be a condemnation of the media for its reporting around whether or not the U.S. was fully able to destroy Iran's nuclear sites. To read it, quote, "The sites that we hit in Iran were totally destroyed and everyone knows it. Only the fake news would say anything different in order to try and demean as much as possible and even say they were, quote, pretty well destroyed." He calls out, Joe, a number of individuals from various media organizations and goes on to say it never ends with the sleazebags in the media, and that's why their ratings are at an all-time low, zero credibility. There is also zero mention of missiles being sent toward U.S. forces in the Middle East or of troops that were potentially put in harm's way as a result of Iran's retaliation.
Yeah, it's pretty remarkable if you're with us on Bloomberg TV giving you a shot of that Truth Social post. I guess we can assume that the president has concluded his meeting in the Situation Room or is at least taking a break now that he's got access to his personal phone again. Seems to be consumed with the coverage of the first round of strikes, not so much about what's happening right now. It is an interesting moment here as we wait to see if Iran is complete or is through with its retaliation, having targeted bases in the Middle East, namely the massive U.S. air installation in Qatar. No U.S. casualties so far, Kaylee. He didn't mention that as well.
He did not. So we want to get reaction from our political panel who is back with us in this extended edition of Balance of Power. Rick Davis and Jeannie Shanzano, both of them Bloomberg Politics contributors. Rick is a partner at Stonecourt Capital and Jeannie a senior democracy fellow at the Center for the Study of the Presidency and Congress. Rick, when we consider what we just heard from the president, the first thing we hear from him in the aftermath of Iran sending missiles toward a military installation in the Middle East, knowing we haven't heard from him verbally, at least since he told the nation about his decision to attack the nuclear sites late on Saturday night. Does a country that may be concerned about war in this region, that may be concerned about asymmetric actions Iran could still take in regard to terrorism, need to hear more from the commander in chief?
Yeah, no, I mean, look, I mean, you know, he bristles over criticism and the idea that he could put together such an effective military operation in total secrecy and not get everybody fawning of praise, some questioning, you know, how long it's going to take to really assess the damage done, especially Fedor, echoed by his own chief of Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Kane, who said it's going to take us a while to really assess the damage. That's just standard operating procedure. But we know Donald Trump does not adhere to standard operating procedure. He wants his victory lap. So, yeah, I am not surprised he's stewing off the coverage he's seen. It doesn't take any, it doesn't blemish the initiative that he took and the outcomes. They are what they're going to be. If you've ever seen an explosion by one of these 30 ton ordinances, you wouldn't imagine anything other than total destruction would occur. And when you have multiple ones dropped on any facility ever created by man, you would really be suspect to think that anything would survive, any structure or individual. So look, the Iranians said that they dropped in the same number of weapon bombs that the United States dropped on them, they dropped on Qatar. And to me, that's a sounding like, okay, this is all we're going to do. So for them to light up a terrorist front around, you know, Western targets would really escalate this thing. And I think the one thing that the Khomeini has been very adept at is not getting into a direct confrontation, you know, with the United States.
Jeannie, what do you make of this post here? The president is not only talking, as Kaylee mentioned, about whether the nuclear installation was destroyed, but he's calling out by name specific members of the media, even reaching to the C-suite here. Dumb Brian Roberts, he writes, chairman of Comcast, helped to continue this falsehood. Where are we going here in this moment for Donald Trump to be consumed by what the media is reporting or thinking as he emerges from the Situation Room and Iran firing at U.S. forces in the Middle East?
There is a very simple way for Donald Trump to address this obsession with the media, and that is to show us the evidence. He claimed that it was obliterated. We have not seen that evidence yet, and it is not enough to just keep saying something. You have to show the evidence. And there's nothing stopping the president, once they get the evidence, from providing that to the media. Just like there was nothing stopping the president Saturday night when he came out and telling us why he made the decision to bomb a country. What was the imminent threat we were facing? What is the threat to the United States? You know, very few people in the US disagree with the president on the objective of denuclearizing Iran. The question is how best to do it. He decided, for reasons that we still aren't really privy to, that he had to go in Saturday night and bomb them. And so it is fair for the media and the American public to say, did you achieve your objective? And so, you know, this is pretty typical, not just of Donald Trump, but any president. They don't like the media to be the fourth branch of government, but that's what the media is supposed to do. We don't just accept what people say and claim. We provide evidence, and the president can provide that, and he should as soon as it is available.
Well, as we look to see whether or not we will get that evidence, either from the U.S., from Israel, from the IAEA, or any other authority on that, we also are keeping track of how the markets have reacted to the events of this afternoon or this evening in the Middle East, with oil down 6.6% on both Brent and WTI, and stocks actually on the rise, though we're still seeing a bit of what could be described as a haven bid into U.S. Treasuries. To get back to how this conflict moves forward, Rick, if this is the end of it between the U.S. and Iran, and this gets to the point that Jeannie was just making around the president having decided without seeking congressional authority to bomb another country, does this put to bed the concerns around constitutionality of the president's actions here, of the effort we've seen, frankly, in both chambers, in the House and the Senate, to try to force votes on war powers resolutions? Is if this is all as far as this goes, do you think those things will be seen as necessary still on the Hill?
No, I think that it was a pretty specious argument on the Hill. I think Lindsey Graham handled it pretty well this weekend on Sunday shows, talking about how, you know, within Article 2 of the Constitution, the Commander-in-Chief has exhaustive powers on dealing with the military and making decisions like this. And he pointed out it wasn't that long ago that Democrats were applauding Barack Obama for doing very similar things in Syria and Iraq and in other places in the Middle East, where he launched attacks that were unauthorized by Congress, and no Democrat complained. So I think this is business as usual, politics playing itself out on national security issues. It's unfortunate, but it is standard operating procedure, and I don't think it goes anywhere from here.
President's supposed to fly away to the annual NATO Leaders Summit tomorrow, Jeannie, presuming he still attends. How does this last 48 hours change the conversation he's going to be having with world leaders at an event, say, a month ago would have been focused squarely on Ukraine, Russia, and the spending on defense by each member of NATO?
Yeah, this has quickly vaulted up to the number one issue on the agenda. We hear the president is still going to go. It would be understandable if he decided he couldn't leave the country at this point. But I do think it is important what distinguishes one of the many things that the president did over the weekend and what we've seen in the recent past is that other presidents, Republicans and Democrats, have consulted allies. I mean, Kayleigh was just talking about the lack of consultation to Democratic members of Congress in this context. He didn't consult allies either. This is a president who is not only an interventionist, but he wants to go it alone. And I bring up again Andrew Jackson, because Donald Trump has described him as one of his favorite presidents. And this is very much in the Jacksonian mode. We can do it and we can do it alone. And I think the allies are going to have a lot to say on that. And just to go back to the War Powers Act, Rick mentioned Article 2, rightly so. The president is the commander in chief. But we also have an Article 1, Section 8, which says Congress has the power to declare war. And the administration is falling over itself to say this isn't a war. But when you attack another country, by international law and by most people's assessment of U.S. law, you have engaged in a war. And so it is not as simple as saying the president is the commander in chief, he can do whatever he wants. That's simply not how the U.S. Constitution was written or how we should operate. That said, this is a Congress, and Rick is right on this, which has gone along with presidents for a long time. My view is if you want to do that, then change the Constitution or write a law which allows the president to act unilaterally. We don't have that now. And so this has likely been a violation of U.S. international law and U.N. standards and operating procedures.
Analysis from our panel in overtime with Rick Davis and Jeannie Shanzano, Bloomberg Politics contributors. We thank you both. Thanks for listening to the Balance of Power podcast. Make sure to subscribe if you haven't already at Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can find us live every weekday from Washington, D.C. at noontime Eastern at Bloomberg.com.